All things equal, we're going to be speaking about Nirvana after this. After that, everything changed indeed. After Nirvana, everything changed. Cobain and his band ushered in a new era in music, bringing the authenticity of US underground punk to a mainstream rock audience. A new book called Nirvana, A Detailed Guide to the Band That Changed Everything, is the new book by our old friend Mark Burrows. And I'm delighted to say we welcome him back onto the show. Mark, how the devil are you?
I'm very well, thank you very much. Nice to be back. How are you?
Yeah, I'm incredibly excited because, as the saying goes, I was there. Yeah, early 90s, living in London, when watching The Word on late night TV, when the Scruffs came on, Terry Christian introduced them. I remember it, and I went, "What on earth is this?"
And what you'd have seen, booked by the way, by Joe Wiley. Joe Wiley, the Radio 2 DJ, Radio 1, Radio 2 DJ, at that point was the live booker for The Word, which is why you have that amazing run of 90s bands of Nirvana, Rage Against the Machine, Smashing Pumpkins, Manic Street Preachers, all of those. But yeah, so that would have been Nirvana's first TV appearance on The Word. That would have been the grunge, although I'm not sure whether they technically count as grunge or not. That is a massive argument for another time, probably. The alternative rock American trio of Dave Grohl, Chris Novoselic, and Kurt Cobain playing Smells Like Teen Spirit, and I believe that performance started with Kurt Cobain saying that Courtney Love of the sensational pop group Hole was the greatest in the world.
Indeed.
Which caused some ripples, particularly for his girlfriend, who didn't know about it until that point.
Oh, ouch. Indeed. I mean, that's another conversation about Courtney Love and Hole as well. Let's not even go there. But if you look at the timeline at the time, okay, Guns, I remember reading a Sunday Times supplement, which says all you need to know about it, saying that Guns N' Roses were the most dangerous band, rock and roll band in the world, okay? We were at the end of big hair metal. Yeah, I'm talking Whitesnake, I'm talking, you know, all that Motley Crue, haha. I'm talking about all that frippery and whatever, and so much makeup and with the whole thing. And then this lot came out of left field, and everybody suddenly went, okay, here we go again, you know, complete sea change.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, NME once described Nirvana as the Guns N' Roses it's okay to like. And they kind of, I think, you know, Guns N' Roses had their place. I think if you're looking at that pantheon of terrible hair metal bands from the 80s, you had your Def Leppards and your Motley Crues and your Poisons and your Whitesnakes. Guns N' Roses are actually on the better end of that. Yeah. Like, they, particularly in the 80s, they were, you know, they were doing something interesting and different. And they were a little bit grittier. By the 90s, of course, they were a rock dinosaur. They were huge and lumbering and not turning up on stage, basically almost extinct, soon to go extinct for nearly 20 years, pretty much. And then in the middle of it, suddenly you have Nirvana. Now, Nirvana come out of nowhere for a lot of people in sort of mainstream. You know, they you hear the first bars of Smells Like Teen Spirit and it explodes and you go, oh, this is something I've never heard before. If you followed music, if you're into underground music in America, Nirvana are kind of the end point of this thing that kind of starts in the late 70s with Black Flag and sort of authentic punk and this idea of punk authenticity. And it kind of gathers pace in the underground. There's a load of really interesting stuff happening in underground music all the way through the 80s in the US, right through, and stuff like the Butthole Surfers and Minor Threat, which are sort of seen as these kind of principled economic socialist principled bands who are DIY and they do their own stuff and they put out their own music. And that's all happening underneath this layer of big haired rock of extreme and Motley Crue and stuff. And then, and Nirvana are kind of an endpoint of that, of all this kind of underground punk that's happening. Kurt Cobain grows up on that stuff. He loves that stuff. You know, he had the only tattoo Kurt Cobain ever had was for K Records, which was a tiny, tiny label out of Olympia, near Seattle, a college town, which put out really weird, cute music where no one could play the instruments. They didn't have a bass player and they changed it and there was really cutesy stuff.
Yeah.
And he was into that and he's also into Minor Threat and Black Flag. But at the same time, he was into Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin and the Beatles. And what Nirvana comes from is this clash of that kind of underground, truly DIY, completely raw, completely punk edge stuff with classic rock and classic melodies. And that's what Kurt Cobain brings in. And it's this perfect synergy of these three musicians, because Nirvana had been around for ages before Teen Spirit. Like, you know, Nevermind was their second album. John Peel first, Nevermind comes out in 1991. John Peel first plays Nirvana in 1987. Like, it's, you know, they'd been around, you know, they'd been building up, but it had all been very underground. They'd gone through five drummers. And then it all kind of comes together when Dave Grohl joins, who becomes like their forever drummer. And you have this complete, this guy who can just whack the hell out of the drums, just hits so hard and so powerfully and accurately, which is what they'd always missed. Tied to these incredible melodies. And then Chris Novoselic, the bass player, brings his own thing as well. Great bass player, but also a great personality and great on stage. And suddenly you have these three, these things that all come together at exactly the right point. And it's not just about the right band, it's the right band at the right time, with the right influences at a point where music needed them. Because as you say, those big dinosaur bands, Guns N' Roses, were exciting in 1988.
Yeah.
But in 1991, they were a lumbering beast, you know, and we needed something else. Even in Britain as well, the kind of, you know, the indie boom had kind of died away. Baggy was kind of dying off. You needed something to come in that was sharp and clear and brutal, but also melodic and authentic. And authentic is a word that constantly follows Nirvana around, and you can't get away from that.
Because, you know, Guns N' Roses had gone down, they were heavy, they were influenced by heavy metal, but they'd done, like Motley Crue did, they'd done the, you know, the groupies, the junkies, they were going down that old trope. Nirvana weren't bringing that. And again, Mark, you know, you're a rock historian and a music journalist. You know the underground punk scene. You know, if you might say US punk scene to anybody in the UK, they'll go Green Day, you know, maybe Pixies, and that's it. They don't know Bleach, this, you know, Henry Rollins, all that lot. They'll just go, no, not a clue. So, because is it going through college radio, which is again an underground situation? Is that how they're getting play, and is that how they're getting following?
Exactly. And college radio, like, it's very difficult if you're a British person, particularly if you're a British music fan, then as now, to understand how the American music scene worked at the time. Like, you know, we had in the UK, we had John Peel on Radio One, a national radio station. We had, you know, and other DJs, and Mark Goodyear at the time as well. We had NME, Melody Maker and Sounds, and Kerrang, four weekly music magazines. Nationally syndicated weekly music magazines. Like, we had access to music, as in America, it was a very different story. No national radio. MTV was pretty much the closest thing you had, but that was very limited in what it played at the time. So you had, as you said, you had college radio. College radio was how these bands thrive. That's where REM Get Famous. That's where all that kind of and Pixies and all those kinds of bands, like underground bands, they're picked up by college radio. That's all anybody ever wanted, was to be a college radio band. That's as far as big as anyone ever thought they could be. And college radio is syndicated. It's amateur radio DJs at universities. And syndicated is the wrong word. College radio is localized, very, very localized. But the local thing is kind of its strength. And they tend to look at local bands, take local bands as serious national bands. And this all comes out of, there was a record label called Sub Pop.
Yeah.
Based out of Seattle, Washington. And Sub Pop came out of a fanzine of the same name. Fanzines, massively important. Again, this is how you found out about stuff. You followed fanzines. You ordered them at the back of other magazines, other fanzines. That's how you found your community.
A photocopy, would then turn up. Something photocopied and stapled would arrive like two weeks later on your front doorstep.
Exactly, yeah. And the Sub Pop was a fanzine, but it was a fanzine that was concerned with music that wasn't underground and, crucially, wasn't coming out of New York or L.A. Because New York and LA were the centers of the music industry in the US, thus the centers of the music industry in the world, really. So they were looking at regional. Sub Pop, ran by a guy called Bruce Pavitt, were looking at regional music scenes. Every issue focused on a different scene. Portland, Oregon, Austin, Texas, and found all these little outlets, all these tiny bands that came out of nowhere. He started putting together cassettes, moves to Seattle, writes a column, forms a record label with another guy, and they start putting out local bands and looking at these local micro scenes. And they basically create one in Seattle that is not really like anything else that's happening in the US anywhere. And Seattle becomes its own little micro scene.
Well, is it a weather thing? Do you think it's because the weather is kind of like Britain, i.e. it rains all the bleeding time? And so,
yeah
I mean, they've said that, haven't they, interviews since, the two surviving members, because there's very little, you don't go down the beach and surf or hang out, so like, you know, the Chili Peppers are doing. You are basically stuck in its cold and it's wet and there's forests everywhere and it's...
Yeah, exactly. This is cold, miserable, working class music. Because actually, Nirvana weren't even from Seattle. Nirvana were from Aberdeen, which is a really small logging town in Washington, State, not yeah. Washington D.C., which is where Dave Grohl was from, actually. But where there was a lot of punk. But they were from Aberdeen, a little Washington logging town. No one amounted to anything if they came from Aberdeen. They went and became lumberjacks, and that's why everyone's wearing this, what became fashionable slacker gear, the lumberjack. Yeah,
I'm still wearing, you know, that kind of shirt. Exactly.
The plaid chic. There was no plan behind wearing those kind of clothes, those sort of slacker clothes. It just what would people wore, because it was warm and practical and cheap. So people wore them, and then they become fashionable, which is again, but I think that's everyone crying out for something that was authentic and real, and not just this kind of, because music, rock music especially, had become so manufactured, so processed. It looks ridiculous, it sounded predictable. And so when you've got all these bands coming up out of this scene and that have all of these connections to all real authentic music, like what was that, they wore their authenticity as a badge of honor, that kind of scene, and Nirvana are marrying that to, and then all those rock bands, you know, like you say, the groupies and the junkies and the strippers, and they're all obsessed. They're all kind of connected with that, which is all stuff Nirvana were vocally anti. They were vocally pro women's rights, feminism. Kurt Cobain's girlfriend, a couple of years before he met Courtney Love, was the bass player in Bikini Kill, one of the most important feminist punk rock bands. You know, they were overtly feminist, overtly pro gay rights, overtly like anti government, and it was all so you had this. The politics was really right on. It was, and again, it's authenticity. So you kind of had all of this coming together, and young people. They were legitimately young people, which is what I think is important. Youth cultures come from youth. From young people.
Yeah, and I mean, basically, you've got the kids of the 80s, you know, they've got a new generation of kids coming up, and they want their own sound, and they don't want to be metal. Okay, they can be thrash, they can be, you know, Anthrax, Metallica, whatever. But that's another subsection, another conversation. But you need something to latch onto, and Nirvana speak for it, and Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, yeah. Mudhoney, you know, all these bands coming out of that particular area.
Yeah, and all of those bands connected, all massively interconnected, all coming through Sub Pop Records or people connected to Sub Pop Records that traded band members. There were like those early gigs happening in 86, 87 in Seattle. Like, they weren't massively well attended. They were put on in like in gay clubs and strip clubs and places like that, because no proper music venues thought it was worth putting on anything but pub bands playing covers or tribute bands and stuff. So they, you know, kids formed their own scenes, found their own venues. And the reason they all knew each other is because they were the audience as well as the bands. Like, they were the same people. Like, you know, Soundgarden played, and everyone who was in Mudhoney and Pearl Jam went to see them because they were their friends. And like, that's how the scene was formed. Nirvana was slightly separate to that scene. Nirvana, even then, weren't they, like, those were the cool kids. Those are the bands you expected to make it. You look at Soundgarden, and a band whose singer Chris Cornell was gorgeous, yep, for a start. Good looking bloke, fantastic
voice.
The voice is fantastic, conventional rock voice, but it could sing the sun out of the sky. You know, you expect them to be the big stars. Nirvana were the weirdo outsiders, even in that scene, even in the scene where you've got the sort of rock star end of it, of Alice in Chains and Soundgarden and Pearl Jam, and then the scrappy punk end of it, of Mudhoney and the Melvins and bands like that. And I really hope your listeners know any of these bands, but if you don't, like, you've got, like, you're into punk rock, these are the best. Like, go and listen to the stuff. Go and listen to Mudhoney's Touch Me, I'm Sick, one of the great alternative rock records of all time. Like, there's some great stuff there. But Nirvana were the outsiders even of those scenes.
Yeah.
Like, they were weirdo rednecks. They were seen as rednecks because they weren't from Seattle. They were from Aberdeen. They were from down the road. People always talk about Seattle, but actually, Nirvana had a foot in Seattle and a foot in Olympia, which is another college city just down the road where there was much more underground cutesy pop music.
Right.
And that's why you've got both of those sides from Kurt Cobain of like melody and aggression. And it's what they bridge the two.
And it's a three piece. Let's not forget, because, you know, Pearl Jam is not a three piece. Soundgarden at that point isn't a three piece. You know, so it's stripped down. So you've got nowhere to hide, have you, really?
Well, Nirvana were a three-piece to begin with, and they were a three-piece when they were famous. There was a period when they were a four-piece. Oh. Nirvana had an extra guitarist, a guy called Jason Everman, who isn't on Bleach, the first Nirvana album, but yeah, he is credited on Bleach because he paid for it.
Is this guy like the Pete Best of grunge then?
Well, yes, because he's fired from Nirvana, who decided they want to go back to being a trio, and joins Soundgarden as a bass player.
Oh, wow.
And then he's fired from Soundgarden they get that big as well. He's got a really interesting story, actually. He goes off and becomes a Marine. He becomes a war hero in the Gulf.
He's got some issues to get rid of for a start, I would imagine, after that. Yeah, yeah.
But he was in Nirvana for a while because Kurt wasn't a great guitarist. He wasn't, you know, he had a distinctive guitar style, but he struggled to sing and play at the same time. So they went, let's get another guitarist in. And they got this guy called Jason Everman, who was much more your classic grunge, hair flailing, head banging on stage, could play the widdly widdly bits. But that's not Nirvana. That wasn't what Nirvana were.
There was very little widdly widdly. How do they, I mean, okay, so far so great. You're the biggest band in Seattle. The move to Sound City, how do they get that record deal, and how do they go down south, as it were?
So Sound City is the legendary recording studio in LA where Fleetwood Mac recorded the self-titled Fleetwood Mac album, and there's loads of other classic, and Barry Manilow as well. There's loads of other classic records made there. So Nirvana were on this little label, Sub Pop, which they hated. Kurt Cobain hated being on Sub Pop, no interest in being a Sub Pop band. They were just the only label that would sign them. And they were desperate to be on any other label, and they'd written to every other label imaginable. And what was happening is they were becoming a phenomenon. They really recorded Bleach, the first album, and it's one of the great albums that come off that label. It's a really great, it does well. It's getting underground buzz in the UK, which is a huge deal in the alternative world in America. If you can get big in the UK, that gives you buzz at home. Yeah. You go, oh yeah, they're listening to, you know, this is on John Peel. This is being mentioned in Melody Maker, this kind of thing. And Sub Pop were very smart. They flew a Melody Maker journalist over, a guy called Everett True, who treated him like a king for 2 weeks. And he wrote about what's happening over here. This is incredible. And he falls in love head over heels with Nirvana. And he's got a really big part of that into how credible and cool they became in the UK. But they're getting this huge like following because their live shows are amazing. The singles are great. But, you know, it's just all coming together. And eventually they get serious management because they become friends with Sonic Youth. Sonic Youth being a New York underground band. But Sonic Youth had major management. They had proper management.
Well, and Sonic Youth have been doing this since the late 70s, early 80s, so they are bona fide legends. And, you know, they are icons, aren't they, in the underground scene?
Exactly, yeah. And they make outside of music that's also accessible, and that's very, very much what Kurt Cobain wants to do. So he really looks up to Kim Gordon and Thurston Moore from Sonic Youth. They become friends. They recommend Nirvana to their managers, and their managers go, oh, hang on, this guy, this scruffy kid, as Kurt Cobain, 5'7", I think he was, for a short guy, beautiful blue eyes, scruffy but sort of, you know, kind of angelic at the same time, has this incredible singing voice that doesn't sound like anybody. You know, he's got something of John Lennon in it and something of Ozzy Osbourne in it but then loads of other elements, and Paul McCartney and loads of different things are all kind of mixed to his voice, then tore through a shredder. And that's kind of, and it's, no one sounds like that. And they see the potential, and they basically go, yeah, we're going to get you off that label. We're going to get you on a major label deal. And they get them a deal with Geffen, which is the label that Guns N' Roses were on.
Huge.
And that's, that's when things start to happen. And this is the point where they get Dave Grohl playing drums. Mm. Yeah, they need a new drummer. Chad Channing, the previous drummer, is no Nirvana drummer is ever fired. They're all just not told they're not in the band anymore. Like almost every drummer Nirvana had before Dave Grohl found out they weren't in the band anymore when they saw Nirvana playing shows without them. Chad Channing was no exception. And Dave Grohl had been in a punk band called Scream, like a proper hardcore punk band. They'd split up. He was looking for a new band. He was in LA around the same time that they were down there playing some gigs. He gets hooked up with them, loves Bleach. Auditions, first play, show, first rehearsal, they go, oh, it all syncs. Everything's perfect. He's exactly the right person to play in that band. Suddenly it works. They'd already made some demos for what would become Nevermind, their big album, the first big Nirvana album. They'd already written Lithium and In Bloom. There's demos and Polly, which are some of the best songs in the record. First couple of rehearsals with Dave Grohl, they write Smells Like Teen Spirit. Which is essentially a Pixies ripoff. They'd be the first to tell you, but it's, you know, they play it live and people are suddenly going, what is that song? What is that song? And parachuted into Sound City Studios, which then was a bit ramshackle, yeah. But in LA with Butch Vig, the producer. Butch Vig had just made the first Smashing Pumpkins album. Billy Corgan, when he heard Nevermind, apparently went, that's my guitar sound. and then Butch Vig learns a lot of lessons making Nevermind, which he then takes to the next Smashing Pumpkins album, Siamese Dream, which is a completely different story. Yeah. But yeah, you get they and magic happens on those sessions.
And like, I'm just watching my time because you know what we're like. We'll be here till next week. So
oh, yeah.
Now Nevermind comes out. Let's not. We're dissing MTV, but the difference that MTV makes when that video hits MTV, the world explodes. They go and get Nevermind, yeah. And I remember being in London. You know, I was in my 20s, and everybody just went, "What on earth is this?" Then you know, Pearl Jam comes out, then Soundgarden comes out with their stuff as well. Suddenly, every A&R man is running up to Seattle to try and find the next Nirvana. Mm. But they go from underground Sound City to just going kapow massively.
Yeah, to being legitimately one of the biggest bands in the world. I mean, they've not in terms of actual numbers, not as big as people think. Their like cultural impact was way bigger than their actual sales. Dave Grohl has sold far more records for Foo Fighters than he sold with Nirvana. Mm. But I don't think he's made anything as important with Foo Fighters as he made with Nirvana, because Nirvana opened the door. And of course, what happens is an existential crisis, because you've got this band who value authenticity and have all of these extremely right on values. But they're suddenly in this world of tabloids and MTV and, you know, world being on source. The front cover of the Rolling Stone, headlining festivals, people wanting to play stadiums. You know, they turned down Guns N' Roses. Guns N' Roses asked them to open for them and they turned them down. There's a great story where, Axl Rose is, at an MTV Awards where Axl Rose comes up and Courtney Love, Kurt Cobain's girlfriend at the time, is being all mouthy and
really Courtney, say it's not
who
so.
Knew
who was thinking
and Axl tells Kurt Cobain to tell your word
your person
to shut up to shut
be quiet.
Your word up yeah. And he just turns around and goes shut up like and then. Stephanie Seymour, who is Axl Rose's supermodel girlfriend, turns to Courtney Love and says, "Are you a rock star? No, are you a model?" She says, "Are you a model?" And Courtney Love turns back to her and goes, "I don't know. Are you a brain surgeon?" This is just incredible. They then spit on Axl Rose's piano on stage, which they later turns out to be Elton John's piano.
Oh, blimey! And that could have been the mother of all meltdowns.
Yeah, they're the antithesis of that, but they're also now in this world, and that's what causes Kurt Cobain this massive existential crisis. Because on the one hand, he wants his music heard, he kind of wants to be famous, he wants to be seen as this hugely respected star, but at the same time, he wants to be seen as authentic. Mm. He's the same guy. He's the kind of guy who was in the press complaining that his records were played too much and listened to by the wrong people, but would also be complaining to his management if he thought MTV weren't playing his new video enough times. And there was a schism down the center of Kurt Cobain. It was a schism at the heart of that sort of music. How can you be both things? Mm-hmm. How can you be massively authentic and whilst also being popular? And it was, you know, and tragically, that was Kurt's undoing.
Yeah, I mean, because we all know the drugs, etc., yeah. The heroin, the whole thing, and then we have the build up for, because there's the MTV Unplugged session, which we've all seen that, and we know how brilliant that was. And then there's this massive build up to the second album. And when it comes out, if you're expecting sort of Nevermind 2, if you're one of the headbanging fans, this is completely not what you're expecting to hear from them.
Yeah, MTV Unplugged is actually happens after In Utero comes out. In Utero is the third Nirvana album, although as far as a lot of people at the time were concerned, it was the second Nirvana album, because they, you know, if you were just paying, you weren't paying attention, you didn't know they'd already had all this underground stuff. And people were expecting Nevermind 2. They're expecting more Smells Like Teen Spirit. What they got is an album that starts off with this, with a song called Serve the Servants, which opens with this discordant slash that comes out of nowhere, this complete noise. And then the first line is, "Teenage angst has paid off well, and now I'm bored and old," which is one of the great opening lines of all time. And it's a really brutal record, but then it's got the sweetness to it. Heart-Shaped Box is the big single from that album. Is a very commercial single. You know, there's some great ballads on that record, and they sweetened it. Now, it was produced by this guy Steve Albini, who is known for making noisy, authentic, scratchy rock, punk rock records. And the record company went, "Yeah, we don't think it sounds good enough yet." And Nirvana didn't go, "Hey, no, absolutely not. You're not touching our piece of art." They went, "Yeah, okay." and they quite happily let them remix it and brought in Scott Litt, who was REM's producer, to remix the singles and sweeten them up. And they recorded new acoustic guitar and backing vocals and stuff to sweeten the singles. So again, there was that contradiction of a band who on the one hand wanted to be authentic, but on the other hand were happy to play the game.
Go back to the first line there, "But now I'm bored and old." I mean, yeah, okay, it's done, you know, get it out there, you know. And Cobain's in trouble, isn't he, at this point? I mean, he's not a happy chappy, to put it mildly.
No, not in the slightest. I mean, he had a heroin addiction that he'd been struggling with on and off for years. He had a chronic stomach issue. Yeah. So he was in constant pain. And he was just, you know, he was not, yeah, as you said, he's not a happy person. He doesn't enjoy being famous, but he can't handle not doing everything he can to maintain that credibility and that fame. And that, you know, we know eventually, I'm sure people know eventually, Kurt Cobain kills himself. Cobain shoots himself in the head, which is one of the most horrible tragedies in music history, because I'd love to know what would have happened if he'd lived. I think he would have had a fascinating career. But, you know, mental health stuff, it never is one thing. It's never a simple answer. But dealing with those contradictions was a real struggle for him. Thinking about knowing that he should be one kind of person, the authentic punk rocker, but also being the, you know, the youth hero, the rock star, and he couldn't be both.
And here we are, 30 years later, and my goddaughters are wearing Nirvana t-shirts, and a lot of people are wearing Nirvana t-shirts thinking it's a brand. But it, you know, and you kind of get, you go, okay, so what, you know, what songs do you know? But bless them, my goddaughters get it, because they're my goddaughters, so they know what Nirvana is. from the cradle, I can tell you. But you kind of wonder how Cobain would have thought if he looks back. I mean, God knows how Grohl feels when he sees people wandering around with Nirvana t-shirts, because it's like, because they've become this, it's almost a caricature of what, you know. And Cobain is an artist. He's trying to keep integrity, but he's still young. I mean, we still think, you know, he's 27 when he dies, you know?
Yeah.
And so how do you keep the integrity? It's just such a difficult one for him.
And I think that if he saw that, I think he would have the same contradictions that he'd always had. That on the one hand, he would be delighted that he was remembered and delighted that people were still taking the music seriously and still listening to him, and that he was seen as a, you know, because Kurt Cobain is seen as a serious musician. He's seen as a serious songwriter. He's seen as a, you know, like he's up there with Ian Curtis or from Joy Division. Yeah. You know, he's seen as kind of a voice of a generation poet kind of thing. No one's going to be unhappy with that as a legacy, but he would have known. But at the same time, he would have felt, you know, he was always terrified of being seen as a sellout. And I think, but you know, that contradiction. As I said, he insists when they asked to change the front cover of In Utero because for sales in Walmart or Kmart, one of the two, the big American chain, everyone expected him to kick back and go, no, don't compromise my art. And he agreed. He put a plain sleeve over it because he knew that when he was growing up, those were the only places you could buy records. And he always knew you had to be accessible. And he was accessible. All of his stuff is accessible. He wrote great pop songs. He wrote great riffs and great screaming, angsty pieces of vitriol, but he wrote incredible pop songs.
How, when it comes to writing this book, and I've only got a little bit of time left, but how do you bring something new to it? Because they've been analysed, psychoanalysed. I mean, Mark, how do you go about bringing something new to the party, as it were?
With this, I really wanted to make it about the music and the band. I didn't want it to be about Kurt Cobain. I didn't want it to be a soap opera. I wanted it to be about where that band came from. The way the book's organised is it's a timeline. It's a very specific timeline of almost dry details. And then that timeline is footnoted, and the footnotes are where all the stories are. And it's more, there's actually, the word count is more footnote than it is the rest of the book. The footnotes are sometimes entire pages.
That's my kind of rock deep dive, I tell you.
So you get to, so, you know, I mentioned when I first mentioned Sub Pop, I then go into, I use that as a springboard to then in the footnotes do an essay on Sub Pop records and where they came from. And yeah, as it goes through, I'm basically letting the story tell itself. So you've got this very bare bones, here is what happened in what order, the important gigs, the important events, the important times, and then what does that tell us? Then what does that tell us about these things? And then, so it's partly a book about Nirvana, yes, but it's also a book about the era and about the time and about the context. It's all about context. And I didn't want it to be about the same story. There's loads of great books about Nirvana. I own most of them. Like there's some brilliant ones. And this is also almost the case of pulling all the information out of all of those books into one place, fact checking it against each other, and then explaining the context of those events. So you can kind of feel the time and the place and the sights and the smells. That's what I'm trying to do.
If people want to find you online, where can they find you, Mark?
I am 20th Century Mark. That's 20th Century MARC on all social media platforms. The one that we still insist on calling Twitter, Instagram, the ones that are trying to replace the one we still call Twitter. You can find me on all of those, or markburrows.co.uk.
Brilliant. The book is called Nirvana, a detailed guide to the band that changed everything. Mark, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Same as always. I'll see you for the next one.